So good afternoon, everyone, both to those joining us in person today and those who are also joining us online. I am delighted to welcome our speaker today, Professor Niv Dan. I should really say to welcome Niv back because her connections with Cambridge and with this faculty are strong and long-standing. Niv was an undergraduate at Girton College. She then went on to take an LLM at New York University and an MA at King's College London. She worked for some time in the Irish Competition Authority before returning to Cambridge in 2009 to follow her PhD in competition law, which talked about the relationship between competition and regulation. And her thesis was published shortly afterwards as a monograph by Cambridge University Press. She was a fellow of Fitzwilliam College for 2 years before she took up a lectureship at King's College London. And from there, she moved to the LSE, where she remains, and she's now a full professor. I remember Niv as one of the most brilliant students that have passed through this faculty, and she's today a leading light in the field of competition law. She has published very extensively in the field, in top journals in competition law. And more recently, she joined Alison Jones and Brenda Suffren in the publication of the last 3 editions of Jones, Dan, and Suffren, who I'm sure any student in competition law would recognize instantly as a Bible for competition lawyers. And I understand that the manuscript for the 9th and last edition was delivered only a few days ago. So today, Niv has chosen to speak on effectiveness and coherence in Article 102 of the Treaty on the Functioning of the European Union. As you all know, the search for an effective enforcement of Article 102 has been a constant theme in the application and in the interpretation of this provision. And surely, a prerequisite for effective enforcement has to be coherence. So nobody better than Niv to bring this topic to life. So without any more delay, I leave the floor to Niv.
Thank you so much, Albertina. Albertina was both my director of studies at undergraduate and my PhD supervisor, so I owe so much to her. Thank you all for being here. Thank you to the CELS team for the invitation. Today, I am talking about effectiveness and coherence in Article 102. And to give you some idea of the genesis of this piece. So as Albertina mentioned, we recently submitted the manuscript for the next edition of Jones and Suffren. And so I've spent the last few months doing the kind of deepest of dives into the recent case law on Article 102, decisional practice of the Commission, the scholarship. And Article 102 is a very broad church. So for those of you who are not familiar with it, it is the EU rule regulating abuse of dominance. So where an undertaking has very significant market power, EU law, the competition rules prevent it from doing certain things, from abusing its market power in certain ways. It covers a very broad range of behaviours, as I'll talk about in just a few moments. And so I have been reading a wide variety of decisions of applications of Article 102. And one of the questions that I've been trying to think about as I look across the very many examples of its application is, to what extent is it applied in a coherent manner between different categories of behaviour? Is it coherent with other aspects of EU competition law and even beyond? In parallel, there has been this huge debate within EU competition law generally, but Article 102 specifically, about whether Article 102 is in fact an effective provision. So that Heike Schweitzer and Simon de Ritter published an article a few years ago, which I will talk about more in a moment, where they described Article 102 as a failing provision. They said, actually, it is not working well at all in practice. And then they give some advice as to how one might save this failing provision. But there is something of a perception that the effectiveness of Article 102 could be better optimized. And so I've tried to think, going through this sort of broad swathe of recent case law, of what effective enforcement might look like and how effective is Article 102 in practice. And so really what you're getting today, hopefully in a coherent manner, is my thoughts on the most recent Article 102 case law. So I'm going to be focusing on case law that, if you have, you're familiar with the current edition of Jones and Suffren, really a lot of it's not in Jones and Suffren, because it is representing the kind of the most recent examples of enforcement practice of the case law of the courts. What does Article 102 entail in 2026? Where have we gotten to at this point? If I were a braver scholar, I would not have chosen a very boring title like Effectiveness and Coherence in Article 102. I would have chosen the title Abortions for Some, Miniature American Flags for Others. And to explain this slightly title, so I'm a geriatric millennial, and geriatric millennials believe that there's basically a quote from the TV show The Simpsons that can explain every single phenomenon in life. And so this particular quote comes from one of the Halloween episodes, which is they're always slightly surreal, the Halloween episodes. And in this particular episode, two aliens land on Earth, and for complicated reasons, they end up both running against each other, contesting the 1996 presidential election in the US. And the alien who wins is the one who realizes quickest that the best way to appeal to a broad swathe of voters in the US is to run on the platform of abortions for some, miniature American flags for others, because you kind of cover all your bases in terms of the electorate. To a certain extent, I think you see some shades of this in Article 102, particularly if you look at the decisional practice, if you look at the case law coming out of the courts. There's kind of an effort to try and please everyone, to have a very economic, technical, sophisticated Article 102, but also a very useful, vigorous application of Article 102 that can catch lots of different practices and can be used quite instrumentally to try and deal with a wide variety of, you know, economic and social ills. Whether this actually leads to a coherent or effective application of Article 102, I think, is a more open question. I'm not sure that I'm going to give you a definitive answer to that question at the end of this presentation, but I am at least going to try and point to things that you might want to think about in making up your own mind as to whether Article 102 is on the right path in terms of achieving the broader objectives of EU law. I'm assuming that most people in the room are pretty familiar with Article 102, but just for anybody who may not be so familiar, Article 102, as I've said, is the treaty provision regulating abuse of dominance. It is very broadly pitched. It gives a number of examples of behaviour that might amount to abuse. So exploitation, exclusion, discrimination, tying. But it's long established from the very earliest jurisprudence under Article 102 that this is not an exhaustive list. You take a teleological approach to what might be prohibited by Article 102. Giuliano Amato described Article 102 and indeed Article 101 as magic boxes capable of expanding their contents. And I think you really see that in the most recent case law, the idea that Article 102 can kind of adapt to address emerging market problems that might not have been foreseen when the treaty was drafted, you know, back in 1957. Abuse is an objective concept. So the language of abuse seems to kind of has, you know, some pejorative connotation, seems to imply some degree of bad behavior by the defendant undertaking. But that's not actually required under Article 102. So you don't need to demonstrate fault or bad intention to have a problem. You don't even need to show misuse of the market power. The concept of abuse is independent from the dominant position that is a threshold requirement for jurisdiction under Article 102. But you do importantly have what's called the special responsibility. So if you're a dominant firm, you ought to know you're dominant. You have an exceptional responsibility to preserve structural competition, effective competition in the market. You're supposed to think ex ante about how your behavior might impact the market and to not do anything that could harm effective competition in the marketplace. And there has been this renewed focus on Article 102, on EU competition law more generally in the last decade or so, but in Article 102 in particular. This is linked in part in efforts to regulate big tech. Of course, the EU has done a lot of big tech regulation in recent years, but prior to that, Article 102 was one of the primary focus for the more kind of ad hoc regulation of
big tech companies like Google, Microsoft, Facebook, Apple. You'll see these names coming up in the cases that I talk about in just a few moments. But it's also related to greater emphasis on the benefits, the advantages of having structural competition in the market. This is partly for economic reasons. There's a lot of recent research that suggests that markets are becoming more concentrated and we are seeing negative economic impact as a result. But it's also linked to political arguments, a kind of claimed link between competitive markets and democracy and freedom, and an idea that we need to, beyond considerations of efficiency, of economic benefit, we should keep markets open and competitive for this more politically oriented reason. So that's the kind of very the potted introduction to Article 102. So the title of my talk refers to an effective and coherent application or approach to Article 102. Let me talk a little bit more about these two concepts. I'm not entirely sure why I lit upon these two as the focus, but I do think they cover together. They cover a pretty well the kind of range of concerns that have been raised in relation to Article 102 today. So the principle of effectiveness has for a very long time been a really key consideration within EU competition law. It is, on multiple occasions, it has been invoked by the court to support, to justify, to motivate a very expansive reading, both procedurally and substantively in terms of the reach of the EU competition rules. And it is certainly something the Commission is concerned about as well in terms of Article 102. So the Commission is in the process of trying to recalibrate, to reorient its own approach, its guidance on Article 102. And in doing so, it has said that it's important that Article 102 is applied vigorously and effectively. So effectiveness playing this really an effective implementation application of Article 102 recognized as a really important requirement. What does effective Article 102 look like? Well, I'm going to suggest three different ways we might think about effectiveness in the context of Article 102. The first links to this Schweitzer and Derrida piece that I mentioned previously. So in an article published in 2024, Heike Schweitzer and Simon Derrida, they diagnose what they call the dysfunctionalities of Article 102. And they identify essentially the fact that the Commission takes too few cases under this provision, and it takes way too long to actually conclude these cases successfully or otherwise. They correlate this, they link it to, but they don't necessarily go so far as to say it is caused by the movement towards a more economic approach. And the more economic approach to EU competition law is all about bringing in more technical economics to the assessment of whether behavior should be prohibited or not. You don't simply look at the form the behavior takes, you actually look at its actual or anticipated effect on the market and ask, is it actually harming structural competition, effective competition? Is it harming consumers? They say this much more kind of extensive duration of cases, this the far fewer cases the Commission is taking can be correlated to the adoption at the same time of the more economic approach. And this links to concerns that have been raised more generally about the duration of Commission enforcement proceedings. This was something that was raised in the Draghi report on competitiveness in the EU, published in September 2024. It is a really key finding in the Commission's evaluation of Regulation 1 of 2003, which is the enforcement regulation for EU competition law, which gives the Commission its enforcement powers. A consistent theme in the responses to the evaluation published last year is that it simply takes far too long for the Commission to complete its cases. A variety of reasons were identified as to why this is the case, many of which are procedural, but also the movement towards a more economic approach and greater use of economic analysis is tied up with this. So one way of seeing effective enforcement as Article 102 would be to show the Commission taking more cases and concluding them successfully, more expeditiously. A second dimension potentially of effectiveness relates to certainty. And again, this is a key theme of the Commission's efforts to reorient Article 102 in the draft guidelines. And it was also something mentioned in the Draghi report, the idea that the Commission should be providing greater guidance for businesses. There are kind of two dimensions to this certainty issue. There's certain legal certainty as a legal value, as a kind of a fundamental principle of EU law, that firms should know what they can and can't do so that ex ante they can direct their business behavior in a way that complies with the law. No surprises in law enforcement, because of course the application of Article 102 is law enforcement. It results in findings of infringement against firms. They have broken EU law, often very large fines, potentially behavioral or structural remedies. But it also links to the question of commercial certainty in the interest of efficiency, making sure that firms are directing their business behavior in ways that comply with the law. So you're not going to have uncertainty. You're not going to have the costs associated with uncertainty in commercial terms going forward. And as I say, this desire for greater certainty and clarity, precision in terms of Article 102 and what it requires, is a contemporary theme in the debates. I think there's an interesting counter argument in a piece published by Ruprecht Podsen and co-authors, which was written in response to the Commission's public consultation on its new Article 102 guidelines. They say Article 102 has always been a provision for complicated and novel cases. It is not a provision for the massive transactions. And that being the case, maybe we can deal with a greater degree of uncertainty than we would find desirable if we had legal rules that are going to be applying to, that are going to be regulating, that are going to be in many ways interfering with business behavior that is undertaken by a very large number of undertakings. If you contrast Article 102, say, for example, with the treatment of vertical agreements, Article 102 potentially applies to tens of thousands of vertical agreements put in place across the EU member states. We need some clarity and certainty in terms of how it applies to vertical agreements. But Article 102 is for exceptional cases. If you look at the cases the Commission has taken, they're against undertakings like Google, Apple, Facebook, really, really big companies, Teva, one of the largest pharmaceutical companies in the world. These are extraordinary circumstances, extraordinary positions of market dominance, really kind of limiting the scope of application of Article 102, meaning that maybe there's more scope for an acceptable case-by-case approach in these circumstances. There are arguments on both sides, but I do think it's an interesting perspective. Of course, it is contingent upon having quite a restrictive approach to applying Article 102, saying that it is limited to the extraordinary case of dominance and reading the dominance criterion as something that's very sort of narrow, that only captures a small number of undertakings. It is beyond the scope of this talk for me to flag that in its draft guidelines, the Commission, when it discusses what sorts of market shares might support dominance, they say in passing, a 10% market share probably wouldn't support dominance, almost certainly wouldn't support dominance, but still leaving open the possibility that an undertaking that only holds 10% of the market could be found dominant. Now, that's a very, very wide-ranging approach to the dominance criterion, which I think is at odds with the perspective that the Podsen piece suggests. The third, I suppose, conception of effectiveness when it comes to Article 102 is where we kind of get in to more disputed territory, which is you might see Article 102 as being effective to the extent it is successful at achieving its regulatory goals. It's the question, what are the regulatory goals of Article 102? Of course, there are very many ways of looking at this. For several decades prior to the kind of about face in 2023, the Commission pursued a single regulatory goal, which was essentially, as reflected in the EAGCP report in 2005, improved consumer welfare. The idea being that the one thing we know that that competition law that Article 102 can do well is to enhance consumer welfare by preventing inefficient market behavior. That's what we should be using Article 102 to primarily, if not exclusively, achieve. Much more recently, the Commission has moved away from this. And so in the policy brief that announces the change In policy, the shift in policy with respect to Article 102, the Commission says that Article 102 could be used and has been used to achieve a diversity of goals, such as fairness, level playing field, market integration, preserving competitive processes, consumer welfare, efficiency and innovation, and ultimately plurality and democracy. I think there are very few people in the room who would disagree that all of those goals are socially worthwhile. There is something that we should be seeking to achieve moving towards. It is, I think, more of a disputed question as to whether Article 102 can make a meaningful contribution to all of those goals. So I don't think very few people disagree that we should be trying to achieve these things. Whether Article 102 is the appropriate, because it's going to be the effective vehicle to achieve these, is a more disputed question. And there's also a question about potential conflicts between those goals. So if you are using Article 102 as a tool to break up market power to enhance democracy, well, how does that square with using Article 102 as a means by which to maximize dynamic or static efficiency within the marketplace? And there is a very significant potential for conflict if you have a plurality of different goals. And you might even take a more kind of overtly public interest approach, as the Draghi report recommended, saying that you should use the competition rules. Specifically, they said state aid and merger control, but there are potentially some applications of this idea in relation to Article 102 to pursue public interest objectives. So global competitiveness, the Draghi report mentions specifically China and the US, or security and resilience within markets. How do we factor that into the application of Article 102? So that's effectiveness. Coherence. I think there are multiple different dimensions of coherence that we might want to think about when it comes to Article 102. So do we have a coherent treatment of different examples of the same type of behavior, same type of harm? So for example, is the treatment of different forms of exclusion coherent across the different approaches you see under Article 102? There's also coherence across treatments of different categories of abuse. So is the approach to exclusion coherent? Is it compatible with the approach to exploitation? And does it matter? Should we actually worry about trying to have a consistent approach where the harm might be very different, or the mechanism by which the harm arrives is very different? A third dimension of coherence that is of increased importance following the Grand Chamber decision in European Super League in 2023 is coherence across different competition provisions. In Super League, the court said, I think for the first time, they certainly don't cite any previous case in which they've made this statement. They say that Articles 101 and 102 must be interpreted and applied consistently. And that's something that has been something of a question mark in some of the earlier case law. Should we take different approaches to essentially the same behavior if we're approaching it through the lens of 101 or 102? The Super League case says essentially, no, you have to apply Article 101 consistently with Article 102. You could also think about coherence with other areas of EU law. Now, I'm not going to look at that specifically in this presentation. There's a really interesting case called Orlan from a couple of years ago, where it was an appeal by a third party against the highly controversial commitment decision that the Commission entered into with Gazprom in, I think it was 2018. And one of the arguments made by the appellant was that the Commission, or applicant, was that the Commission ought to have factored in energy security. So some of the kind of energy related goals that you find in the treaty when entering into this competition commitment decision. What the court says is that the Commission is obliged to apply and interpret Articles 101, Article 102 in that particular instance in a way that is not at odds with other aspects of EU law. Of course, it can't arrive at an application of Article 102 that directly conflicts with other treaty provisions. It has to take them into account. But they say very clearly that when acting as competition regulator, when enforcing the competition rules, the Commission's powers are limited to addressing competition issues. So you can't directly pursue other regulatory goals, even if they are, you know, treaty level, primary treaty level obligations. You cannot approach them through the prism of competition law enforcement. You're restricted to looking at competition issues. Now, you can take the wider regulatory context into account as part of the kind of more contextual analysis that is an aspect of the movement towards a more economic approach. We understand whether behavior is problematic by looking at the behavior in its wider context under both 101 and 102 now. The recent case law makes that very clear. So it is potentially relevant, but you can't use the competition rules directly to pursue other potentially socially valuable goals, but goals beyond competition law. And you do see the occasional use of Article 102 directly to pursue internal market goals. The AB InBev case, the Mondelez case from 2024, where the Commission finds breaches of Article 102 by firms that are held to be dominant and where the behaviour is directly putting up barriers to interstate trade. They're both dealing with firms that one sells beer, one sells chocolate. They're trying to prevent sales across member states. They're trying to prevent arbitrage. Those actions are held to be an abuse because they are at odds with the goal of market integration. So that's effectiveness, that's coherence. Where do we get the contents of contemporary Article 102? If Amato says that the contents of Article 102 are constantly expanding, where do we find the contents? Well, they're shaped by, obviously, Court of Justice decisions, both appeals against Commission infringement findings, but also a lot of 267 references. Super League was a 267 reference. A lot of important recent cases have come for the court through that channel. Commission decisions, both infringement decisions and commitment decisions, and also what the Commission tells us we should be taking from Article 102. Firstly, in its enforcement priorities document from 2008, and now in its draft guidance on Article 102, which really radically changes the approach that was the earlier approach that was advocated. There's no single definition of what an abuse entails, but what I'm going to talk about for the remainder of this presentation are three sort of key strands of the case law. I'm going to focus on exclusion first, then I'm going to ask whether discrimination or harm to equality of opportunity can and should be seen as a distinct category of harm. And then I'm going to speak briefly about exploitation because there's been a couple of recent interesting cases that seem to change things in that area as well. So exclusion is really the paradigmatic Article 102 abuse, the kind of historic conventional definition of an abuse from Hoffman LaRoche only seemed to foresee exclusion as the only way which would violate Article 102. Super League qualifies this by adding the phrase, as a rule, this is how you show abuse of dominance. But it's certainly in terms of enforcement practice, exclusion of competitors as an abuse is the primary, I'd say, the paradigmatic category of abuse. And it has been the exclusive focus of the Commission's guidance, both the 2008 guidance and now the 2024 draft guidance. The emerging case law, some very recent cases, Servizio Electricity Nationale, SEN, I'm going to call it, Unilever Super League, cases 2022, and then 2023 cases, they identify a kind of surveying the massive enforcement practice. They identify two cumulative requirements for any exclusionary theory of harm. You've got to show the behavior departs from competition on the merits and it has capacity to produce exclusionary effects. And the Commission's draft guidelines have adopted these two requirements as what it calls the general principles. So there's a lot of discussion of the general principles to show abuse. And then the Commission also acknowledges and discusses the established areas with specific legal tests, which have a more particular or a more distinctive requirement to demonstrate that, say, predatory pricing or refusal to supply amounts to an abuse. One of the criticisms of the guidelines is that the Commission doesn't really do very much to explain how the two approaches fit together. So how you might see the general principles reflected in the specific legal tests. Multiple commentators have remarked upon this and said it would be more helpful if you kind of gave us some more guidance as to how we see one reflected in the other. Let me just talk briefly about these two requirements and then I'll talk about the as efficient competitor principle. So competition on the merits is something, it's an idea
that you find in the very earliest case law back in Hofmüller-Rausch from the late 1970s. But it has been very clearly and I think deliberately rehabilitated in the more recent case law as a way to try and explain, you know, to kind of delimit the acceptable parameters of competition by dominant firms. Because the case law says it's not a problem to be dominant. Dominant firms can and should exist in the market and compete vigorously, but there are certain things they can't do. And so in order to try and draw that line, the concept of competition, the merits or normal competition is invoked. What do we mean by competition, the merits? Well, as a kind of amalgamation of the recent case law on this, the draft guidelines say that conduct refers to conduct in the scope of normal competition on the basis of the performance of economic operators, and which in principle relates to a competitive situation in which consumers benefit from lower prices, better quality, and a wider choice of new or improved goods and services. In particular, if you see exclusion of competitors from the market because the dominant firm is offering the better product at the lower price, that's going to be competition on the merits. You might have exclusion, but it's not going to be abuse of exclusion. What sort of things might constitute a departure from competition on the merits? Well, to give you some examples from very recent enforcement cases, in Teva, the defendant, the dominant firm, lodged a bunch of divisional patent applications. It was a pharmaceutical firm. It lodges a bunch of these patent applications and then strategically withdraws them in order to frustrate a new entry into the market by generic competitors. Making a divisional patent application is completely legal under patent law. It's not a problem under competition law, even if you're dominant. Withdrawing those applications is not a problem. It's something that's permitted under patent law. But it was the fact that the firm was doing so strategically in order to make life so much more difficult for its competitors that was held to be a departure from competition. It wasn't normal. It wasn't meritorious competition. Similarly, in Teva, but also in Vifor, these cases find a disparagement to be an abuse of dominance. So providing would-be customers of your competitors with objectively misleading information about competing products, which serve to kind of discredit those competing products, that is also held to be a departure from competition on the merits. It's perfectly fine to provide information about efficacy of drugs, about safety of drugs, about your products, about competing products, but you can't provide information that is objectively misleading where it's part of a strategy to basically dissuade your customers from sourcing products from your competitors. And Google Ad Tech, a recent infringement decision from last autumn, where it deals with Google's ad tech business, where it provides services to publishers, advertisers, and also an online ads exchange. The problematic behavior was it used services for publishers and its subsidiary, which provided services for publishers and for advertisers. It essentially provided a strategic advantage to the ad exchange in a way that was actually detrimental to the interests of the subsidiaries in the advertising service and in the publishing markets. So it was held to be something other than competition on the merits because it was disadvantaging the subsidiaries themselves. And it was doing so in a way which was very clearly intended to kind of provide additional support to kind of give a leg up to the ad exchange business. And so this is held to depart from competition on the merits. The Meta Platforms case, not a commission enforcement decision, but an interesting example where a grand chamber sitting of the Court of Justice says that in certain market circumstances, a failure to abide by other regulatory obligations outside the competition sphere, in that instance, the GDPR, could amount to a departure of competition on the merits where that regulatory obligation has a really significant impact on normal competition. The failure to abide by that standard could be evidence of a departure from competition on the merits. It's not the case that every dominant firm that doesn't obey other regulatory obligations has abused their dominance, but in certain circumstances, it can indicate departure from normal competition. And interestingly, in terms of coherence, this is a concept that we also see arising in Article 101. So generics is a case involving both 101 and 102. And there, the Court of Justice says I'm running behind a time, so I'll try and go more expeditiously myself. They actually use the same idea across 101 and 102. Capacity to produce exclusionary effects. Here, the core case, as anybody who has studied Article 102 will know, is Intel. Intel very clearly establishes, or it sort of articulates for the first time, this idea that inherent in any exclusionary abuse of dominance is the idea that the behavior is the capacity to foreclose efficient efficient competitors. Sometimes this is going to be implicit, but defendant firms can always raise an objection that the behavior lacks capacity, the Intel court tells us. And in a recent reference case, the Talina Group case, the Court of Justice used the understanding of anti-competitive effects as developed in the Intel case law to confirm the interpretation of the same concept under Article 102. So again, you see some efforts of the court to try and have coherence across the different competition rules, specifically where we are dealing with restrictions by effect. As I kind of do the small bullet point here, too much information on this slide, but basically it's something of an open question as to what you have to show capacity to foreclose. There's lots of different formulations in the case law. You don't need to show actual effects, but you need, or concrete effects, but you need something more than a hypothetical theory of harm. Things are complicated by Super League, because in Super League, almost in kind of a throwaway fashion, the Court of Justice said, but of course, there are some categories of abuse where you don't have to show actual or even potential anti-competitive effects. It's enough to show that the undertaking acts with the object of restricting competition. And here, this is a direct parallel to Article 101. So Article 101 has restrictions by object and by effect. There's no mention of that in 102, as the general court in Google Shopping really emphasized. In Super League, however, the court introduces the language of object restrictions, and that is reiterated. They sort of copy-paste in Google Shopping. They copy-paste the relevant paragraphs from Super League into the judgment. So it appears we have a category of object restrictions where it may be the case that you don't need to show even any capacity to restrict competition, even potential competition. What might fall within this category? Well, I think the recent case law would suggest that what are called classical tying cases, so tying under Hilty, predation below average variable cost and refusal to supply to hinder interstate trade, as the commission applied in the Mondelez case, potentially fall into this category. If anything falls into this category, it is embraced by the commission in the draft guidelines in the guise of a naked restrictions. And I think you also see it reflected in the rebuttable presumptions of exclusionary effect that the commission suggests, because even if Intel tells us that all behavior must have the capacity, or all exclusionary abuses must have the capacity to foreclose, in the guidelines, the commission has taken the approach that for a wide variety of behaviors, you can rebuttably presume that capacity to foreclose. The as efficient competitor principle, let me just talk about this more generally. So the kind of the two building blocks, the general principles for exclusionary abuse are departure from competition on the merits, and capacity to foreclose. But sort of overarching all of this is the as efficient competitor principle, which the court introduced, or recognized, kind of articulated, I think, most clearly for the first time in post Denmark 1 in 2012, where the court said the purpose of Article 102 is only to protect efficient competition. And the court has continually reiterated since then that mere exclusion resulting from the normal functioning of the market mechanism is not protected. It's not recognized. Even if it's exclusion, it's not abusive exclusion. Abusive exclusion. And you see this reiterated in all of the kind of recent cases. SEN, Unilever, Super League, up to sort of Android Auto last year. This can be operationalized via an AEC test, which if you've studied Article 102, you're probably very familiar with. It's a cost-price-based test, which tries to figure out whether a hypothetical competitor, if they have to pay the same effective price, would be able to stay in business. How does the as efficient competitor principle map on to the two requirements I've just talked about, the general principles? In the draft guidelines, the commission suggests it's actually relevant to both. So it's kind of this overarching idea that can inform both what we think of as competition on the merits, but also capacity to produce exclusionary effects. Let me talk a little bit about the AEC test more specifically, and then I will go to the kind of qualifications of this. This was obviously the linchpin's kind of core intellectual contribution of the Commission's 2008 guidance paper, where they say for all price-based exclusion, we think you should apply an AEC test as a filter. If the behaviour would allow as efficient competitors to compete, well, then it cannot be abusive. The court was a little bit slow on the uptake, but it has adopted the AEC test as a legal standard for predatory pricing, for margin squeeze. And in the most recent case law, even though it's not a mandatory element of the assessment of exclusive dealing, they say as a general rule, if you're looking at fidelity rebates, loyalty rebates, you must apply an AEC test to determine whether the behaviour is problematic or not. And in fact, the court has gone beyond what the Commission said in the guidance paper in Unilever by saying it may have a role in non-price abuses. This really, really irritated Advocate General Cocotte. And she has some very strong words about this in her opinion in the Google shopping case. And in fact, in a number of very recent cases, the Commission has annulled findings of abuse on the basis that the Commission, having conducted an AEC test, didn't do a good job. The court says in Google Android, the general court, if you are going to conduct an AEC test, it must be conducted rigorously. And in both Intel and Android, the court concluded the Commission had not conducted a sufficiently rigorous AEC test, and the finding abuse was annulled. And after a very long time, this has finally been upheld. The annulment has been upheld in Intel, and the Commission didn't even bother to appeal in Android. But where we get into complications is where we go beyond the AEC test. So the AEC test is very sort of clearly not a mandatory requirement. It is described as one tool amongst others. There are some areas where it must be applied, but it doesn't have to be applied across the board to find an abuse. And going sort of developing this idea in Google Shopping, this is the Court of Justice judgment in 2024, the court, while acknowledging, they say admittedly Article 102 does not protect, you know, exclusion, mere exclusion from the market because of the normal functioning of a market mechanism. It doesn't protect less efficient competitors. The court goes on to say it does not follow that any finding of infringement is subject to proof that the conduct concerned is capable of excluding an as efficient competitor. So you don't necessarily need to show to have an abuse that the behaviour is leading to the loss of efficient competitors in the market. This is where things get really complicated, at least in part, as other commentators have said, because the court has not always been clear about when it's applying the AEC test and when it's applying the AEC principle. There are two open questions in the case law. The first is, to the extent that we dispense with performing an AEC test, which the court has said is not mandatory in every case, does this mean we also dispense with the AEC principles, kind of underlying idea that Article 102 only protects efficient competitors in the marketplace, that it seeks to preserve an efficient marketplace? I think that the Intel case very clearly suggests it doesn't, that you can have the AEC, you can be a subject to the AEC principle without the AEC test. The approach of the court in Google Shopping, another grand chamber sitting, on the other hand, suggests that what they did in that case was they dispensed with the obligation to provide to apply the AEC test, and then any consideration of the AEC principle just disappears. They kind of allied the two things together and strongly kind of suggesting that one represents the other. Draft guidelines have a section where they, a very unnecessary section, where they say, here are the things you don't need to prove to have an exclusionary abuse. Why is this in here? It is Asimakis Komnenos has said that it is the anti-guidance paper exorcism is how he has described it, of the court very clearly, the Commission very clearly trying to move away from the more economic approach. But that is sort of something of an open question. What about less efficient sources of competition? Or even if we're bound by the as efficient competitor principle, even absent the as efficient competitor test, when might we be able to take account of less efficient competitors? There's some suggestions in the case law that we, for example, state-imposed barriers to entry, where a dominant firm acts with the object of preventing the emergence of efficient competitors, or in Google Shopping, in the light of the specific conditions of the market. Apologies, I know I'm managing my time very badly here. Which brings me to discrimination. So I'm going to skip this bit, which basically talks about Article 102C. But to what extent might equality of opportunity be recognized as a distinct theory of harm under Article 102, be another way to show exclusion, which is separate from showing the exclusion of as efficient competitors. This notion, equality of opportunity, is recognized as a value protected by Article 102b. It comes from ordo-liberal ideas, or at least there is an assumption that it kind of comes from ordo-liberal ideas. And as early as the kind of Deutsche Telekom case in 2010, the court very clearly said, and a system of undistorted competition can be guaranteed only if equality of opportunity is secured as between various economic operators. I think this is part of the way of explaining Google Shopping, because in Google Shopping, we're dealing with self-preferencing, where the court essentially says discriminatory behavior, deliberate discriminatory behavior that is targeted at competitors can be an abuse, absent any showing of negative effects on a sort of violation of the as efficient competitor principle. In Shopping, both the general court and the Court of Justice acknowledge the as efficient competitor principle, but they say it's not relevant in the circumstances. The circumstances they point to are discrimination. And so it seems that emerging in the case law is this idea that exclusion that is targeted, that is the deliberate discrimination that seeks to exclude competitors, might be an independent theory of harm. Mere discrimination is probably not abusive. You need something, some positive acts of discrimination. And in Google Ad Tech, which I mentioned earlier, the commission points to actual evidence of intention to exclude to bolster the case. But it is emerging as a distinct approach, which isn't bound by the as efficient competitor principle. And in terms of coherence, in Super League, this is a slightly niche case, but the court actually drew an analogy to the case under Article 106, which is the provision that's targeted specifically at state behavior that results in violations of the competition rules. Article 106, has to be read in conjunction with Article 102. When you read the two together, you typically get a much more rigorous, restrictive application of Article 102. More things come within its ambit. The court said in appropriate circumstances, you can actually, if you have an undertaking that sort of has a market position that's akin to special or exclusive rights granted by a member state, they can be subject to those more demanding requirements. And in particular, they're subject to sort of a prescription of certain forms of discrimination. And so again, you kind of see discrimination emerging as a freestanding theory of harm. Very briefly, let me just flag exploitation. I think there's a really interesting something that has always been explicitly prohibited under Article 102A, but the Commission has always been sort of reticent to apply it, no longer. The Commission, there's a really extraordinary statement in the Apple App Store decision from 2024 where they say exclusionary abuses do not take precedent over exploitative abuses. I think this is linked to fairness. I think this is linked to the kind of blurred lines between exploitation and exclusion in digital markets. Just to flag two recent developments. One is the OSA case, which is an excessive pricing case where the court actually, so from late last year, where the court draws an analogy to the Super League and the Sen case law on exclusionary abuses to try and explain how you would go about showing harm in excessive pricing case. OSA is a complicated case. It involved excessive prices charged to intermediate consumers, which is why I think the court talks about an effective competitive structure. But it's interesting to kind of see case law from or principles developed in the context of exclusion brought into the context of exploitation. Query whether they actually really work there. I think it's because it's a reference case. The court was answering the question that was asked to it and probably didn't see the problem there. Certainly, it fits uncomfortably with a very broad understanding of what is a consumer that you generally find in EU competition law. And the big development under exploitation is the rehabilitation of unfair trading conditions in 102B. The in the Apple App Store case, the Commission is kind of honest enough to say there's not very much case law here. They can summon up 4 cases in 50 years, but they say these provide us with some useful indications as to when unfair trading conditions might be a problem. They are imposed on the dominant undertaking unfavoured or detrimental to the interests of third parties and unnecessary, sort of disproportionate. Apple App Store, the commission focused on the detriment to consumers. And that, I think, applying that, and they're able to show both monetary and non-monetary detriments. Where this is more problematic is Facebook Marketplace, where actually the detrimental terms and conditions are imposed on competitors. And by using Article 102A in this way to pursue what is essentially exclusionary abuse, you avoid the problem of having to show capacity to foreclose, having to think about impacts on as efficient competitors. And so to the extent the Commission starts to do this routinely, it might become more problematic. In terms of coherence, let me just go through this very briefly. I think EU courts increasingly willing to develop the content of Article 102 by reference to other competition provisions. The FX-based approach developed in Intel seems to be spreading to other areas, so 102C, 102A, but to the extent that we develop discriminatory exclusion as a theory of harm, or we use Article 102A to pursue exclusion, we won't have those limitations, but we also won't have that coherence. And the AEC principle could provide a unifying thread for all exclusionary behavior, but the Court of Justice has this sort of left open the question of when we might depart from that. Hopefully the long-awaited Court of Justice judgment in Android will answer some of this. In terms of effectiveness, the Commission very clearly wants to move away from the more economic approach in what it's doing, so it could take more cases more quickly. Whether this is a good thing, I think, is a more ideological than a technical question. And while the guidelines aim to provide an authoritative statement of the law, because they also want to pursue this political agenda of changing the law or moving away from the more economic approach, there's a very selective reading of the case law. As you will have seen from this discussion, the case law says lots of different things, and not all of that nuance is kind of acknowledged in the case law. Of course, you might just say, kind of take the approach of Tommaso Valletti, who is a professor of competition economics of Imperial, who thinks that all of this law and all of this case law is absolute nonsense on stilts because Google is a bloody dominant company abusing its power, demoting and discriminating against rivals. Why are you talking about legal tests when you should just be going after the market power? That is it's a legitimate sort of political argument. I think that to be able to kind of defend that, you have to be able to restrict the application of Article 102 to companies like Google, and whether the Commission would be happy with that compromise, which is something to be seen. Thank you very much. I'm sorry for slightly rushing the second part of that.